limits are just 15K. Hope you blow this chance, cause I wanna be a policy opener. Policy opener. Policy opener.
Welcome everybody to this morning's episode of the podcast with probably my most favorite topic, the most asked about topic amongst personal injury lawyers, bad faith / is this policy open? And there's a whole science behind this. We have a very, very special guest, probably the number one, numero uno bad faith expert in California, probably the country. Please introduce yourself.
Ricardo Echeverria.
And Ricardo works at his own firm, which is?
Chernoff, Bedart, Echeverria.
And before we get to that, we're going to talk about that great song we had the intro in by none other than Jenny Anglin, sitting over to my left.
Hi.
That was you?
That was me. That was all me.
Hot.
100% mixed it herself. So we would like to have some drinks here. And who's our drink boy today? Drink boy. Drink boy.
Yeah, it's me.
Please, sir, come. Now, can you just grab that mic over there and tell me, what am I drinking and why?
That is the Southside Ruby Red. It is Deep Eddie's grapefruit vodka, a little mint, and a little lime juice. And I think the sweet part of it is, you know, it's always sweet for plaintiffs when the policy's open. And then the bitter aspect is, I think, the other end of that, when the carriers aren't so happy, that bitter taste in their mouth when they realize that maybe a little bad faith here, and I think that's pretty appropriate.
And the mint, Evan, is green because of
moolah.
There you go.
All right. Thanks, Evan Garcia.
Is it bad that I already finished mine?
Can I fill her up? Oh, he actually really did finish it.
Yeah.
Ryan, that's a strong play at 10:30 in the morning.
I would like another one, please.
Ryan, come on, man. Oh, so strong Ryan, play. Who just downed his drink within 30 seconds of us even started, introduce yourself, Ryan, so we know who's on the podcast this morning.
Ryan Conger.
We have Jenny Anglin to introduce, but Jenny, please say hi again.
Hello.
And to my left?
This is Tom Conroy, the lesser of the Toms at the firm here.
Yeah, we have a couple Toms. He's definitely the lower caliber.
I'm like
Tom.
The backup Tom.
It's like, hey, we need another Tom in here. Tom Conroy.
It's like
shows.
The main model goes down, like breaks down on the side of the road. They're like, oh, put backup Tom out there.
It's true, because we have Tom Fair's email is Thomas@JusticeTeam, and you guys stuck with your last name.
And their band is called Tom Tom.
That wasn't funny.
No. Yeah.
All right. So open policy is kind of a term that's thrown around a lot. It coincides with bad faith. So, Ricardo, why don't you tell, like, we have a lot of non-legal listeners. What does an open policy mean, and how does it interplay with a personal injury lawsuit?
Well, the starting point is to recognize that probably 99% of what funds personal injury lawsuits is insurance. And a lot of people don't realize that when somebody says, I have full coverage, that only means they have a $15,000 policy. So you have to give insurance companies the opportunity to settle a case within policy limits when liability is reasonably clear. And if they fail to do that, they have, quote unquote, opened up the policy. And actually, I like to frame it as they are not allowed to enforce the policy limit, meaning they have to pay for whatever the injuries are.
And why is that important? I mean, why should the injured party be able to then just collect whatever they want from the insurance company if it is considered open?
Well, because the insurance company made the decision not to settle. They have to be given the opportunity. You have to give them all the rope in the world, and they're either going to tie a bow on it and settle it, or they're going to wrap it around their neck and they're going to hang themselves. So you got to give them the opportunity. And if they fail to do it, then ultimately the policy is open. Now, of course, that's going to benefit the injured party, because instead of having a 15,000 policy or a 100,000 policy, they have an open policy that can respond to whatever their damages are.
But we'll say, Ryan, why does the insurance carrier care? Like, why would they just pay more than what the policy is worth? What do they owe it to the injured party?
They don't owe anything to the injured party, but they owe a duty to their insured. There's a fiduciary duty to the insured, and they can't expose their insured beyond the policy limits.
So it's to put it into practical aspect, like Tom Conroy, the lesser Tom, say you have $100,000 policy limit on your auto, and you nail some dude in the crosswalk, and he's paralyzed.
Mm.
Okay, and you say, hey, Tom Conroy's insurance carrier, we'll just take the insurance money, and your insurance carrier goes, we don't think it's worth that much. We're going to offer you $50,000. What has that done to you as the driver?
Well, it exposes me. I mean, there's a paralyzed person that I've smoked in a crosswalk, and there's going to be a...
Well, he wasn't paralyzed before you hit him, unless that was a pre-existing...
No, Brad. It was not. And plus, I'm always very careful in crosswalks. No, but it's, you know, there's going to be a pretty significant claim coming my way. And if there is an attempt to resolve that claim within my insurance policy, which I, as a policyholder, I pay my premium every month. I do so on time. I'm never late. I'm a model customer, and that's why the insurance company owes me a duty of good faith and fair dealing. And if there is an olive branch extended by the claimant and they want to resolve it within my policy limits, that needs to be done. And if it's not, then my insurance company has potentially exposed me to a huge problem down the road.
And Jenny, what percentage of your cases do you feel are settled with insurance money versus someone personally paying out of pocket?
That would be about 100% from my experience. I've had a few cases where there's been a little bit of personal contribution on top of insurance, but that's rare.
And I would think it's rare, and it's also it's exotic. You know, it's not a traffic accident or a premises. When that happens, when someone pays out of pocket, it's an exotic set of facts that occurs in.
Right.
So we actually have three people on this panel that did defense work. I did. Well, actually, four. I did. Ricardo, did you do any defense work before?
Never.
Never. Wow. You're a purist.
I am. Purebred.
But a lot of us, we did a little bit of defense work. So I didn't do any on the personal injury, like insurance defense, but I think the three of you did, Tom, Jenny, and Ryan. How scary is it when you have a situation where you think the policy is open, but maybe your carrier doesn't feel the same way, and you have a double duty here?
Well, I don't know if I would necessarily characterize it as scary, but what happens is when there's a potential for the policy to be open is the policyholder has to be informed this is going on, and they have to be informed of their right to retain private counsel to advise them in that context. And it doesn't become scary, but it becomes a huge burden upon you as the mild-mannered insurance defense lawyer, because now you've got a client who's on edge. They probably have personal counsel at this point, and they're going to be writing you one letter a week telling you you're not doing a good enough job. And it becomes a huge weight upon your shoulders as the, again, mild-mannered defense lawyer who's just handling the file.
You think you're Clark Kent over here? Come on, man.
I do.
Jenny, any experience with this when you were on the defense side where you have that situation?
Yeah, definitely. And for me, the best situation when I had an open policy was when it was opened prior to my involvement, and then I didn't feel like I had that personal responsibility for exposing the insured. What you never want to do is be the one who opens the policy by advising the carrier, for example, oh, this case is only worth like, you know, $25,000, and then it's ultimately worth a lot more than that. So it's difficult in that position because you don't want to be viewed by your carrier as being weak and constantly encouraging them to settle. But at the same time, your ultimate duty is to the insured, and you want to make sure you're protecting them from that open or protecting them from an excess judgment. And so you have to make the right recommendations.
How about you, Ryan? Any of those?
I had very few situations where there was an open policy when I was on the defense side, but I definitely had some where, you know, the plaintiff attorney was contending that it was open, and definitely, like Tom said, Lesser Tom, the mood changes.
I don't like this Lesser Tom thing, man. That was a joke. That was a joke as fair as in the room.
The mood changes and the dynamic changes between you and your client. I think there's a particular case I have in mind where early on in the case, the insured client was appalled that they were being sued. They were appalled by how much the plaintiff attorney was asking for. And then as soon as the letters started coming in saying, hey, we think this policy is open, our demand is, you know, not $1 million anymore, it's $5 million, the tune of the insured definitely changed. And now he was not appalled by the fact that he was being sued. He was appalled by the fact that, you know, the carrier hadn't stepped up and paid.
And Ryan, a lot of time what plays into that is the clients, if they're savvy enough, understand that you are a lawyer hired by their insurance company. or if you're in-house, you have an email address at insurancecompany.com, and the client understands, at least in part, that, or they believe in part, that you may not be looking out for their interest. You're an insurance lawyer.
So let's talk about that, because there's a difference between what personal counsel for the potential excess judgment and then something called cumis counsel. Now, Ricardo, can you educate us on what cumis counsel is and how that's a little different from just personal counsel?
Sure. So in many cases, the lawsuit's filed and there are portions of the complaint that are covered under the policy, portions of the complaint that are not covered under the policy. For instance, intentional conduct is not covered. Negligent conduct is covered. And when a lawsuit like that is brought against the insured, there's a potential for coverage, so they have to defend, but there's also a chance that there's portions of it that won't be covered. So the defense lawyer, if the defense lawyer in the way they handle that case can control the outcome to some extent, they have to hire independent counsel, because a lawyer who's hired solely for the insurance company can say, I want to try to get rid of all the covered claims and leave the non-covered claims, then the carrier's out of the case. But a lawyer who has the interest, the personal interest of the insured, will not want to get rid of those covered claims to keep the defense intact. They'll want to get rid of the non-covered claims. So that's the situation where there's a conflict in the pleading, and therefore you're entitled to independent counsel.
And who pays for that?
Insurance company. Insurance company. Cumis, by the way, is a lawsuit. The name of the case is called Cumis, and it stems from 2860 of the insurance code. And basically what Cumis did is, because people were getting independent counsel all the time, but the rates that they were paying were far more than what insurance company were paying their panel counsel. So the law became clear that, hey, they only have to pay the panel counsel rates, but the lawyer is chosen by the insured, not the insurance company.
Ricardo, would that be a situation, for example, if the allegations were assault and battery, but also self-defense?
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Like, because that, you know, assault and battery, intentional acts, those are not covered under the policy. But if there's also a negligent component, then there's coverage for that. So it really depends on the case, but it's where they're inherently there's some of it's covered, some of it's not covered. That's when you get.
So who do we want? Who do we want paying all these settlements and judgments? Anyone?
Insurance
company. That's your question.
Yeah.
No.
So that's why I think we hinted on it. That's why it's important when you plead your lawsuit, you need to think about what's going to be covered, because some of the things you may allege may not be covered. A lot of these, like Jenny, you have some cases where there's bar fights.
Yes.
Ooh.
And you have bouncers that interact with patrons. How do you at least get the insurance company defending and possibly paying?
It's exactly what Ricardo touched on. You need to make sure that you're not defeating coverage with your complaint. So you need to have those alternate theories of, you have to obviously have the assault, but you also have to plead it as negligence and make sure that you're covered also with potentially negligent supervision, negligent training of the employees and things like that.
You know, it's also worth mentioning here, too, because the general rule is insurance companies do not have an affirmative duty to try to settle the case. The way plaintiff lawyers have to think about this is that you, as the plaintiff lawyer, need to create the circumstances that then trigger that duty to settle. Number one, you got to make a demand within policy limits. Number two, it's got to be at a time when liability is reasonably clear.
Well, okay, Ricardo, you're cutting off my fun game we're playing by naming all the factors we're going to consider here.
Wow, Ricardo, how dare you?
Ricardo, I mean, come on, man, you're ruining it for everyone.
As the expert brought in especially to address this topic, how dare you?
So we usually do a little fun family feud type action, and I create the scoreboard here. So we're going to break up into teams, and since we have this side of the room versus this side of the room, let's keep it a little unfair and have Ricardo and Ryan.
I'll take Ricardo.
Against. This is totally not
good.
Cool.
I'll take Jenny. Good.
Against little Tom and Jenny. Why don't you guys confer amongst yourselves, come up with some cool team name, because we have the top five.
I'm not good at naming things.
Yeah, right.
Tom and Jenny's policy is open. That's the name of our team.
Ooh, how amazing, original, Ryan. Come on, man. Tom.
Our team name is going to be called These Arms Are Snakes.
This is getting pretty dark. This is a podcast after dark.
These arms are fucking snakes.
I think it's supposed to be pythons if you're going like
a No, hole. Don't be simple-minded, Brad. I thought you were a creative type.
So these are the top five ways an insurance carrier, oops, opens the policy. Who would like to try first? I'll decide. Team, what was it?
These arms are snakes.
Wiggly snakes. The wiggly snakes.
All right. What's the question?
Oh, my God.
Oh, name the top five ways?
Well, just name one way.
That the
and you can continue playing if you get one.
Okay, what do we win?
Oh, God. Can we get the greater Tom in here?
All right, so we got to name one way that an insurance carrier opens the policy.
There's the top five. There's a lot of different ways, but here's the top five.
Okay, well.
Confer with your teammate before you just start talking.
Okay, hold on.
Let's confer. Hold on.
Well, I mean, it's fairly straightforward. Yeah. You have a demand made within the policy limits.
And you don't pay it.
And you don't pay it. And it's and there's a free flow of information from one side to the other, such that the insurance...
You're naming like five different things. Can you just tell me?
I don't understand how this can be broken down into five things, though. It seems like a pretty clear thing. No?
No.
Okay, well, I'm just going to say what I'm going to say, and you tell me if I'm right, wrong, or indifferent. demand is made within the insurance policy limits. There's a free flow of information to the insurance carrier such that the insurance carrier can make a reasonable and educated decision, and they decide not to pay it for whatever reason.
But tell me one of those reasons they decide not to pay it. What's something that they'll do that triggers the bad faith?
Well, there's a million reasons they could decide not to pay.
Give me the top five.
They don't believe the liability pick. Now I got my headphones all messed up.
What did you say? What did you say about liability?
Hold on.
Oh my God, this guy's.
I'm having a conger moment. Amazing.
They don't believe that the liability is what the plaintiffs say it is.
There you go. There's number four.
Liability.
Number three on the board. You guys got it. It is to deny liability or skirt liability when it should be admitted or at least some comparative fault should be borne.
All right.
Okay.
Took a while, but we got it.
Yeah, I mean, that's story of Tom's life. So you guys can try to go for the rest of the top.
Rude.
The rest of the top five, or you can pass over and you think these guys won't get the rest of them. What do you think?
I'm going to pass.
Wow.
Oh, that's
pro
cocky.
Move. So Ricardo and Ryan, mostly Ricardo because Ryan's not going to get these. Where the rest of the four, the mess ups, the little things that they screw up on that kind of get you to the open policy.
One of the ones is they think there's no coverage, and they refuse the demand because they say the case may be worth more, but we don't think there's coverage. And that's a classic Johansson situation, which has different consequences.
Classic what?
Johansson.
And what is Johansson?
Johansson's a California Supreme Court case that addresses what the consequences are to an insurance company when they refuse to settle because of a coverage dispute. They're not supposed to consider coverage. And what happens is, if you do establish coverage later, then it doesn't matter if they have the best intentions in the world. If their coverage position was taken in good faith, they have to pay the entire amount of the judgment. So let's say a carrier gets a demand for $15,000. They're defending it, and they tell the insured, you know, we don't think you paid your premium on time. There's a coverage issue, so we're not going to pay the $15,000.
Wow.
And then the verdict comes in at $5 million. And let's say that insurance company had 10 of the best bad faith coverage experts in the world advising them, saying you're perfectly legit to take that position. And you prove them wrong later, it doesn't matter that they had a good faith belief in it, they're still on the hook. So coverage denials as a reason to not settle is one of the things I see
many times. And that is definitely
times.
On the board,
yeah.
Misrepresenting the terms of insurance policy. So you're saying even if they have all the good faith in the world, that they think that there is no coverage here,
right.
If it's later proven that there is coverage and there was the demand made. So for the purposes of this exercise, we're assuming that there was a legit policy limit demand made with all the things you need to do to make it legit.
Yeah.
And they come in and say, hey, there's no coverage here. Or what about a situation where there's something called a drop-down coverage where they say, hey, this person was under the influence of drugs or alcohol, mm-hmm. So in the terms of the policy, we're allowed to take this from a 100K policy down to 15.
Right.
And are they allowed to do that?
If they're right, yes. But if they're wrong, it has consequences. That's the point. It doesn't matter if they have a good faith belief in that coverage position. If they are wrong, it's a strict liability standard.
Ryan, can you make a guess at the three that are hanging out there?
Ryan loves talking policy coverages. He just loves it.
Me answering is kind of like, with Ricardo on my team, is kind of like pinch hitting for Babe Ruth. But how about unreasonable conditions?
Yes, number two on the board, the failure to meet a reasonable condition. Now, this is it's hard to say what is a reasonable condition to a policy limit demand.
Well, I get
is
it.
What I'll, is I'll it? Throw out some things and you tell me, is this reasonable or unreasonable? My client was hitting a crosswalk, is paralyzed. You have a $100,000 policy and the insurance carrier says, you know what, can you please send us the medical bills? We're going to reject it, the policy limit demand, until you show us the medical bills. Is that reasonable?
Let me take a guess, and Ricardo will tell me if I'm right. All right. If the, let's say the police report, or there's some documentation that the guy...
You're showing the insurance carrier the emergency room records where it says severed spinal cord paralysis.
Then I think it's unreasonable for them to say that that case isn't going to be, you know, worth more than $100,000. So we're not splitting any hairs there. They've got enough information to make a reasonable determination that the case is worth what the policy limit is.
Ricardo, was he right?
Yeah, I think so. It depends on the circumstances. I mean, when you have that clear liability, that severe of an injury, and 100,000 policy, you don't need more than 2 seconds to figure that out. And you don't need more medical.
So there's a lot of, like, people put a time limit demand. Is there anything that's considered, like, always reasonable, always unreasonable?
No. It's always, I say it's the diaper answer. It depends. Because it really depends on the circumstances. Sometimes, you know, you could give a 5-day policy limit demand and it's reasonable. What if it's on the cusp of trial, all the discovery is done, and everybody knows the moving parts? That's enough time. On the other hand, you could give them 30 days and liability is not clear, damages aren't clear, comparative fault's not clear, and they need more information, and that may not be reasonable. So it really depends on the circumstances.
All right, guys, we have two left on the board. We're going to go back to Ricardo to see if he can get them. So just, we're putting out there, we have a time limit demand. We give them some of 30 days. We hit all the reasonable conditions. Liability is pretty clear. What's something that the insurance carrier can do that'll mess that up?
So I hate to say it, but sometimes they just screw up and no one looks at it. No one looks at it.
And that's number one on the board. Just not respond. No one responds. You have 30 days and they call you the day before. Hey, we're just looking at your demand now. Can you give us 5 extra days?
Right.
Is it reasonable or unreasonable just to give them a little extra time?
Well, you know, the industry, I don't know if many people don't know this, but about 4 years ago, the industry tried to change the jury instruction that really would have changed the landscape, particularly on this issue. Right now, and we were able to overcome it in the jury instruction fight we had with them, but the only thing you look at is the reasonableness of the demand. Not the conduct of the insurance company. Was the demand reasonable? And it's defined as a demand where the liability is reasonably clear, the judgment's likely to exceed the amount of the demand. If those ingredients are there and they don't pay, then they breach the duty to settle. Sometimes it gets screwed up where they say it's an unreasonable refusal to settle. Doesn't mean that the insurance company conduct was unreasonable. It's that the demand was reasonable and it was not accepted. And the insurance industry 4 years ago tried to add a fourth element to say that you had to prove the insurance company's conduct was unreasonable. And that would have really changed the landscape because it doesn't matter what their conduct is. All that matters is the demand. So, I think you have to focus on the demand itself and whether they accepted it or not.
So we see a lot of these ads when we fight or there's propositions or certain... In other states, in California, they tried to do it, but in medical malpractice, there's a cap on damages, on general damages. So what Ricardo was saying, like, there are a lot of lobbyists for the insurance companies trying to change little nuances like jury instructions or just the legislature, and something as small as that would significantly impact open policy cases because it puts the burden on to show that the adjuster did something wrong as opposed to everything was right and they just made a bad decision.
Correct.
And there's one left. There's one thing left that they could do.
Which ones have we covered so far?
We've covered...
By the way, the foundation, where are you getting this list from?
I made it up. But you guys are getting them all. It's not like you're doing anything off
this
the wall
here. This is picking
here.
Brad's brain.
So yeah. That's a dangerous exercise,
my friend.
Counter offer.
Oh, there we go. You guys got them all.
Yeah. Well, we didn't get to hear from Jenny. She could have got all those, I'm sure.
They were all in my brain.
Yeah, exactly.
The bold counter offer.
How does that work, Ryan?
From the defense perspective, you guys probably remember doing this. There's kind of an art to it. If you feel like, you know, maybe he would take a little bit less, but I'm afraid if I say, you know, let's say it's $1 million demand on $1 million policy, and you feel like it's a little bit borderline, and you think maybe he would take 800 or 900, I could shave a little off the policy. If you make a formal counter offer at 800 or 900, you've now rejected the, let's say, reasonable policy limits demand, and you could open the policy. So what I think some defense lawyers do is they'll call you up and kind of feel you out a little bit and say, hey,
nothing in writing.
Hypothetically speaking, you know, would your client ever, I don't have any authority to do this. I'm not making an offer right now. But hypothetically speaking, would your client maybe entertain like 750 if that could get it done right now? I don't have authority for the policy, but, you know, so be wary of that. Of that call, because they're sniffing around to see if they can get a discount. They may have the policy, and they're just trying to be a hero.
So what's the difference? Because you could have a situation where the plaintiff sends out a 998 offer or demand, and during that 998 offer, that's for a policy limit or within the policy limits, is it considered open if the defendant tries to negotiate within the 30 days or 35-day window?
I think so. I think if the demand was reasonable and it's pending and you make a counter, the policy could be opened. We have I won't name any names, but somebody who sends us a lot of good cases loves this response. This is a great quote from him. He says they'll make a counter or something, and then they'll write back and say, hey, what do you, you know, would you take the policy now? And he loves writing back and saying, sorry, there's no pending demand. That's a scary thing to read.
It's really contracts 101. Once you put the demand out there, it has to be unequivocally accepted. If it's anything short of that, it's a counteroffer, and you no longer have to renew the demand.
I don't know, though. I think a 998 is statutory, and you're allowed to negotiate. And that's what I wanted to know, because you're allowed to negotiate within the 998 period, and it doesn't invalidate the 998, but does it invalidate an open policy or validate an open policy if you make a counteroffer when you're statutorily allowed to do it?
Well, it's two different things. You may not get the 998 result, but you do have an open policy. Those are two different things. You don't need to do a 998 to open a policy. That just has to be a demand.
I had an attorney tell me that one time. This policy isn't open because you never did a 998 for the policy.
You know, this whole thing of counteroffer, to tell you how important it is, it kind of showcases the importance of why it was important we didn't have that added fourth element, because I have a case, and I won't give specifics because it's confidential, but it was involved a quad and a para, clear liability.
When you say quad and para for the non-legal listeners,
quadriplegic and paraplegic injuries, severe injuries, 20 years old, clear liability. The driver had a $15,000 policy. Well, the lawyer before me made a demand for the $15,000, ghostwritten for the clients, and in that demand specifically said, do not include any third parties in the demand because I want to see if I can hold them accountable. It could be like the state of California, whatever, anything. The insurance company writes back and says, we accept your demand. And in the release, it has third parties are released. So it comes to me, I file the lawsuit, and PI lawyer's on the case, and then about a month later, bad faith lawyer gets on the case. And I know...
Who's that bad faith lawyer?
I can't tell you. Can't tell you. So, because I don't want it to be too much, very confident. But anyway, it comes back and said the insurance company wants to assert an affirmative claim of settlement, that they settled the case for $15,000. I said, great, let's get that skunk out on the table.
Well, Ricardo, you were getting way ahead of my podcast schedule here, because that's one of my last questions.
Okay.
And let's just dive right into it, because it's a unique scenario that not a lot of people ever think to do or would ever think to do, but... Would you want to litigate? Was there an agreement or not before you even go to trial on the actual damages case?
I did it in that case. And the reason you want to is because to work up a quadriplegic and a paraplegic case, you're going to spend $750,000, maybe even $1 million, to work it all the way through trial. And doesn't everybody want to know if you settle the case for $15,000 in advance of that, both the insurance company and us? Yeah. I mean, it makes sense, right? And
so
that's
how,
what we
how
did.
How did you approach that with the defense counsel? Was it your suggestion? Did you plant the seed, or did they affirmatively ask, let's file dueling MSJs, MSAs?
Yeah, they brought in the affirmative defense of settlement, and I welcomed that. I said, great. And let's kick out the trial on the PI case for a year. Let's do cross motions for summary judgment. And we did. The judge's tentative was to deny both. And I said, well, there's one thing we all agree upon is you can't do that. You got to decide it. It's the legal effect of undisputed facts. And ultimately, he said, nope, the counteroffer. They took a writ. That was denied. And then we settled the case.
So there was, you probably saved yourself probably thousands of attorney hours.
Well, yes and no. We settled it on a high low.
It went to trial.
Well, right before trial, they ended up paying the entirety of it.
Okay. Hmm.
So that's your helicopter outside?
but it's important to understand these nuances. Otherwise, you know, you take $15,000. They knew that we knew our way around the insurance policy, and once we got those rulings, it was an open policy.
I've always thought about this. What happens if you say, so you're in that scenario, right? And you want to know in advance, plaintiff says policy's open.
Yeah.
The insurance company says, no, it's not. We're trying to decide whether we're going to go through, you know, many hours and
right.
thousands and thousands of dollars of litigation. If you say, if you send the insurance company a letter saying, we are willing to arbitrate that issue now, and they say no, in some ways, isn't that kind of bad faith to their insurer? They're dragging their insured through.
Well, the way I approach that now is I bring a cause of action for declaratory relief. I say the insurance company claims that they settled the case. I say they did not, and let's get that skunk out on the table and let's have it decided. So bring it affirmatively, and if you got an insurance company that's practical about it, why wouldn't they want to have that decided in advance? Let's see if we settle the case or not. It saves them money if they're right, and lets them know that if they lose that they got to work up the case for a reason. But that's usually how I try to approach that. Just get that injected into the case so that it's got to get decided.
All right, so we're going to move on to some listener emails. And these are questions that we get a lot. Simon Firm, 100,000. Okay, here are the basic facts. We're going to go around the room and we're going to play, is this open? And Ricardo is going to give us the actual answer. Simon Firm, $100,000 policy. Client's treating physician recommends surgery if epidural injections fail. Client undergoes 3 rounds of injections, which fail. We made a demand for the insurance limits. The insurer offers $35,000. Is that open? Tom Conroy.
I need to know if the insurance carrier has been provided the information that the medical sequence will play out like that. Do they have that information?
They have everything that that we've gone over.
Okay. Is there a surgical recommendation on file?
Very good question. There is not. There is a, if epidurals fail, you are a surgical candidate.
Also, who wrote that? Who wrote
it's
that?
Treating
report?
Physician. We'll say it's an orthopedic surgeon.
Depends on who wrote it, too.
What's the liability picture?
Let's assume liability is admitted. Clear.
Okay.
What do you think? Because this comes up a lot. $100,000 policy, maybe wishy-washy surgical recommendation. Is this open?
How much are the bills?
35.
Oh, you want to know the Howl meds?
Yes.
The Howl meds for, you know, what's actually a reasonable 3 rounds of epidural injections? $30,000.
You know, if there's a record or something that the insurance carrier has from the surgeon which says conservative treatment has failed, this person will need to move on to the surgery, then I would say that's probably open. If the conservative fails, then she will need the surgery. It's kind of gray area for me.
Jenny, what do you think?
I agree. I always called that the soft recommendation. It's not really a surgical recommendation.
You don't like it soft. You want
like
a hard.
I prefer to have
surgical recommendation.
Right.
Ryan, what do you think?
You know, I always try to look at it from a couple different perspectives. One, if I were the insured there, would I prefer that my insurer go ahead and pay that? I think so. I mean, I think if I'm personal counsel, I'm writing a letter that I'm saying we don't have a firm surgical recommendation, but it sure seems like it might happen. This is a scary one. I don't want to expose. I don't want to myself. I don't want to be exposed. I don't want my personal counsel client to be exposed. But from the perspective of the plaintiff's attorney, that's not one that I'd be excited about dumping a bunch of money into either.
That's what I was going to follow up. Is that something where it comes to you and you say, let's green light some major fusion surgery on a lien now?
Yeah, I think if you're playing it conservative from the insured's perspective, you're trying to tell the insurance company that's a risky one, you should pay it. If you're playing it from the plaintiff attorney perspective, I think that's not a smart one to dump a bunch of money into. It's kind of an in-betweener.
And before we go to Ricardo with the answer, I think we should maybe establish, because I get this a lot from newer lawyers or people just learning this area, you know, open policy, bad faith, it's not a button you push.
Right.
You know, it's not policy's open, click, pull the lever, you know, drop the bombs.
Right.
It's at best a claim or leverage you have for a second trial down the road about whether or not the insurance company acted in good faith. So we use words like policy's open and, you know, bad faith and all this stuff, but it's not a mechanical function where you pull the lever and that's it, and the red light goes off.
So, Ricardo, what do you think about this?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's who has the better argument of whether the policy is open. The reason, though, always keep in mind on those kind of cases where you decide to roll the dice, so long as you beat that and you get a verdict, guess what? In the second case, there is a presumption that verdict is the value of the claim.
But even though the surgery hasn't happened yet...
No, I understand.
Okay.
I understand. But ultimately, if you at trial get a verdict, that verdict value is the presumption of the value. And it's a rebuttable presumption. But nonetheless, you're able to go in there and say, hey, look, a jury decided this thing 2 years ago and they found it was worth XYZ. And there's a presumption that that's the value. But Ryan's right. I mean, Tom, I keep saying Ryan.
It's okay. He doesn't have my hair, but I'll accept that.
But he's right. It's never an automatic. It's who has the... Sometimes you have a really strong argument that the lid's off. And sometimes, like this case is, I agree. Like with Ryan, it's an in-betweener. It's, you got to make a tough judgment call as to whether you're going to roll the dice and
So, right, if this case came to us, is this something we would roll the dice on?
So that's a good question, because that's the context that we're getting it in, not where Ricardo's getting it. We're getting a call from somebody saying, hey, do you guys want to take this case? And more likely, we're getting it where the call comes in and says, hey, now I do have a real surgical recommendation, and now the client is going to actually have the surgery. Do you guys want the case? And I would say, does the carrier know that?
Right.
And if the answer is no, but I think it's open, and I think if we give that information to the carrier, they might pay it. I don't know, to me, and maybe I'm too conservative, but that's enough of an in-betweener that I would say, let's give
it's
that
a tweener.
Information.
It's like a tween.
Right. Let's give that surgical recommendation
right.
to the carrier. And see, and give them another 2 weeks or 3 weeks to pay it. I think that's the smart move.
When I saw
this,
that was the biggest thing for me was if you do get the surgical recommendation, goes back to the treating orthopedic surgeon or neurosurgeon, they say, you failed treatment, I'm recommending surgery. You send that off to them and they don't pay the $100,000. I would be way more comfortable putting money and time into the case.
Think about what that theater looks like in the bad faith trial, because you're right. If you don't give them that, that's going to be their hook, is to say why the policy is not open. Say, hey, look, at the time you made the demand, you didn't have a hard recommendation. You later got it. Had you given that to us, we would have paid the policy. They're going to make a big deal of that. So you might as well give it to them the second time and give them the opportunity on a case with that close of a call.
Is that one of those situations where you can give them a little bit shorter leash, though? Because they had the original demand. They had all the information.
Sure.
The one piece they were missing
it's
was
two
the
pages.
Firm
Here's
recommendation.
Two pages to
sure,
look at.
Sure. Yeah, you can give them a shorter demand. Just remember, the one change that did happen to the jury instructions, I told you that they were trying to say the insurance company's conduct was unreasonable. We fought that and won. But they did add another element that says a demand can be unreasonable for reasons other than the amount of the demand. That could
time
be the time
be
element.
One.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the classic examples. What if you sent out a demand on a Friday at 4:59 p.m. on a holiday weekend and demand acceptance by 8:01 a.m. on Tuesday, and they don't accept it? Well, they're going to say there wasn't enough time. I mean, the demand may have been reasonable. It just wasn't enough time. But I do agree that you don't necessarily have to give them as much time in that circumstance, because you've already set most of the stage for them in advance on the first demand.
All right, we're running low on time, so I'm going to go over some frequent questions that we always get. And this is a big one. Do open policy cases ever settle? Some people assume that an open policy has to be tried.
Are we talking about settlement above policy?
Settling the case above the policy, because it's the insurance money, insurance carrier paying out of its pocket, out of its profits now.
Yeah, well, that goes to what we're talking about as the bad faith open policy thing being a term of art and not a mechanical device, where the carrier, just as much as a plaintiff firm, could recognize risk. And if the carrier sees risk and a strong argument against them in the plaintiff's favor, they'll say, shoot, we kicked this one. We got to put in a little bit more.
So is it like a risk benefit where they may, the plaintiff lawyer may look at it and take less than full value because there is a question mark? Jenny, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think that you have to consider that. You know that you may feel strongly about the bad faith, but would you give a haircut to have some certainty? Of course.
Right.
And Ricardo, how is it different than litigating a normal case where you have $25 million of insurance coverage and there's no issue there versus, hey, I got a popped $15,000 policy? How do you proceed any differently in that situation?
In the case I was giving you the example on, you know, we got the issue resolved by the judge and said it was a counteroffer. Now, it's not automatic. They'll still argue something later, but nonetheless, that's pretty close to rock solid. They lost the writ. We went to mediation right away, did a high-low. It was confidential, so I can't say the names, but I could tell it was $10 million low, $25 million high on a 15,000 policy, which ultimately we were supposed to try to get the high, and they paid it without the need for a trial. So it can very much happen before going to trial.
Another question is, we have three claimants, and you make a policy limit demand on behalf of one of them.
Mm. Good one.
How does that factor into whether or not a policy is open? Multiple claimants for a single accident.
You know, in my insurance defense days, we always found that to be a strong argument in our favor, that there were other claimants out there more than just what was being represented in whatever demand. We always felt that was strong grounds for us.
Get on the phone with the attorney for the other claimants and make a global demand.
Yeah, you have to
do that to make sure that it's open.
Yeah. You know, there's an interesting twist on that. I completely agree with you. You have to get all the players, all the claimants under the one umbrella of the demand for the limits. But I did have a case once where an insured came to me who owned a building, and there were two claimants. One severely burned. It was an apartment complex that he owned. It was a fire case.
Sounds familiar.
And one very minorly injured. The severely injured was making a demand for a $4 million policy. And the insured's like, look, I want to get that one settled. I don't care about this other one. So what we did is we ghostwrote a letter. We told the insurance company, all right, well, settle that case. We got them to make the demand for $3,999,000, saving $1 on the policy. And we told the insurance company, if the other one sues, provide us a defense because there's a dollar left on the policy, but we'll hold you harmless on indemnity. And so
that's a great idea.
So you can get
that.
Them to do it.
Mind blown.
And then the insurance company doesn't have a defense because your insured is telling you, you're going to pay your policy limit, save $1. But I'm telling you, you don't need to pay a nickel in indemnity on the next claim.
And then you're saying, pay me, I'll take on the risk of whatever that claim's going to be worth.
If the insured is willing to do that. Because that happens sometimes when you have one person who's really badly injured and other minor injuries. If you can convince that insured to give authority to the carrier to settle your claim, then you can do it. But if you don't have that, I completely agree that the insurance company has an out because you have to get all of the claimants under the one demand.
That's an awesome idea. Do we have your permission to tell people that that's our idea?
Yeah. I got video proof that it's not.
Wipe clever. The tape. Okay, here's another one we get a lot, and I know the answer, but I just wanted to get it out there so our listeners understand. Ricardo, can you open a first-party insurer case?
What do you mean? Open
it's like you're suing. There's a UIM claim, and you make a demand for the UIM.
No. You can't do that. UIM claims are not open policy situations.
How is that different than a third party?
Third party, because third party, you're suing the insured, and that's what we've been talking about. They have an opportunity to settle. First party claim, you are suing your own insurance company or making a claim under your own policy. There's no exposure to anybody else. It's just the limits that you have for your coverage, so you can't open that up. There's no exposure to anybody else.
So what is the exposure to insurance company if they're not making a good faith effort to resolve a first party case?
They're going to lose a customer.
Yeah, well, no, the thing is, and it's any first party claim, the downside risk to the insurance company is, did they act unreasonably? Did they delay it? UM bad faith cases are the hardest ones because now necessarily when you get to the bad faith case, the benefits have been paid because you won in the UIM arbitration. There's no more benefits to pay.
So what are the damages? Say you're the arbitrator awards $1 million of damages on a 250 policy.
Yes.
Can you sue for the extra 750?
No.
Different?
What you can sue for is your emotional distress putting you through the delay. The added cost that it took for you to get there. If you had a lawyer, did the percentage fee go up because you had to go to arbitration? The arbitration expenses, potentially punitive damages, but that's your damages. You can't open a UIM policy.
And to tack onto that from what Ricardo said, when I was doing UIM work, I would always be told by my seniors that you got to alter your tone on all of these. You got to come in softer, come in a little bit more direct, come in lighter. Because of that, because that's the only real exposure and only real
one
risk.
One last question, then we got to wrap because this is a question we get a lot. What's a burning policy and how does that factor into making a demand? And what do you got to be careful with there, Ricardo?
Burning policy is where the defense costs come off the policy limit. So when you make a policy limit demand, you have to know what those available policy limits are. So when you make your demand, you say, I'm making it for the available policy limits at this time. So if it's burned
up. Is it usually better practice to say the phrase your remaining policy limits or your policy limits versus a hard number?
In a burning policy, yes. But when you have a CGL policy, you know it's not burning policy limit. You just make the demand for the amount. But you know the ones that are burning policy limits are the employment practices liability. Those are almost always burning policy. Some professional malpractice claims are burning policy. So in those circumstances, always make the demand for the available policy limits.
And that's all the time we have here for Ricardo, Ryan, Jenny, and Tom. Little Tom, we're signing off here.
Policy Opener.